Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Hey! We're off! We're off! Hello! My name's Nick and this is
Nathaniel Metcalf.
And you're listening to That's Fan Club. That's what we call it now. We call it That's Fan Club.
That's Fan Club, yeah.
That's what we call it now.
We call it Nick and
Nathaniel Metcalf's
Fan Club.
That's Fan Club. I'm Nick, and as ever, joined by my competent and very capable partner in crime with a K, T-U-R-T-L-E power, Nerds. That's Fan Club. First rule of Fan Club, Nat, is
tell your friends about Fan Club.
Just tell them.
Please tell your friends.
Just tell them. Tell them. I feel some weeks, Nat, I don't know about you, I feel like I'm shouting into a bucket. and not a very big one. And like the sort that you'd buy at a seaside.
Make a little castle with a shovel.
And the second rule of Fan Club is, of course, just tell your friends about Fan Club. What are you drinking?
I've got a coffee. But what I've done here, because in the past, in the pre-COVID days of being in the FUBAR Radio studio when we weren't recording this remotely from our own homes, the FUBAR people had sort of keep bringing us teas and coffees throughout the show, meaning, of course, that come 2 o'clock, desperate for a wee. But I try and recreate that by having a flask of coffee with me so I can get, I reckon, 2 cups of coffee in that, 2 decent cups that should keep me going, hopefully, over the next couple of hours.
I have a flask with me as well so that I can wee in it. And at the end, it's still the same temperature, so I can just pour it into the toilet and the toilet is none the wiser, Nat.
But imagine it imagines the flow is quite heavy. So, oh, great.
No. I had a misadventure once, and so the end of my penis is quite open. what's it like? It's not even like a tap. It's more like, you know, some sort of, like a piping bag, but when you've cut it way too high. So it's basically, you just push in buttercream straight through it. That's brought up unintentional imagery that I didn't mean. I just meant when I'm urinating, really. Because when I'm hard, it closes right back up again. Anyway, so we're off. If you've not been a fan of the show so far, give us 5 stars anyway online.
Doesn't hurt you.
I mean, what's the worst that's going to happen? You'll never listen to us again, and maybe if you hate the world that much, maybe redirecting them to a show that you hate by giving us 5 stars is your ultimate revenge. So how have you been this week, Nat?
I've been fine, you know. I was just saying, it seems to go very fast, the weeks. And I have to go, and it's good, because it holds me account, this show, because I have to think of, what have I done? have I been a fan of? It just feels like we stopped doing this at 4 o'clock, and then about an hour later, we're doing another one. Feels like it's very, the weeks fly by for me.
Well, I mean, this is why we shouldn't talk off air, because now we're just, you know, repeating by verbatim a chat we just had. But my observation on it was we recorded on Wednesday, 2 till 4. We're meant to meet at 1:30. I tend to meet 10:02, but I got stuck in traffic, and then by the time we finish recording, it's 4. Then we have a little chat afterwards, and then it's sort of like it ends up being 5, and then that's Wednesday over. Like, you can do a bit in the evening, but then it's sort of like, well, that's Wednesday, and then it comes out on Friday, and so we sort of like mentioned that, and then it comes out as a podcast on Monday. And so we mention it then. And then and then on Tuesday, it's sort of like you just sort of like getting in your head, right, we've got a guest. Let's think about our guest a little bit. What are we going to talk to them about? And then it's Wednesday, and then, you know, it's 1:30, 2 o'clock, and then and it's just like, it just breaks up the week in such a weird way that it just punctuates every other day. And then it's kind of, weeks just fly by. I hate it.
I feel that. I feel like it's sort of hurtling past me life at the moment. I'm trying to do things. I cycled up to the West End, which I hadn't been up to, into town, which is nice. And it's nice to sort of have a wander around. It's very eerie, very few people. Nothing was really open apart from a little coffee shop where there was a guy who could be anything from about 30 to 50. But he was like a guy with very long hair in a coffee shop playing Pearl Jam very loud. And I thought, he's having a nice time, and he's gone, no one's coming in. So he's turned his music up, and he's playing it loud, and he's not really expecting anyone to come in and order a coffee. But I thought, you might as well, if you've gone to the effort of going into work to make coffee when most people are off at work, at home, play your own music. Have a nice time.
You've got to sort of wonder whether, you know, people aren't there, so he's playing the music, or he's playing the music, so people aren't there. I used to work in a pub, and I used to play my own music very loud, and the customers hated it. But when the manager was away, no one could stop me. But I had a manager once, and he got so drunk, he was younger than me, which was the ultimate humiliation. He got so drunk that he was serving someone behind the bar, and he was sick on his own shoes. So I turned him round and I grabbed him by the scruff of his neck and I slapped him in the face and I said, get out from behind the bar. And I got in just as much trouble as anyone else. And I just think, God, I was trying to save this fucking sinking ship. But it's a different pub now. It closed down after I left. Not surprised. that's true. Anyway, so it's all true. I just grabbed him. I was so disgusted with him. Sick on his own shoes. He was younger than me. I was so angry. He was my manager. It's like, what do you mean? I've been working here for fucking 3 years and he's the manager. He's drunk all the time. He was sick on his own shoes. So I slapped him in the face and I just said, get out! And he did. And there was no medals that day, I can tell you. I was absolutely livid. Anyway, the stand-up career took off and here we are. So, what have you... Are you well? Are you okay?
I'm doing well, yeah. I'm doing all right, yeah.
Just think that as friends, it's important to check in with each other before we just start talking about shit. What have you been a fan of this week?
So what, I've not watched an awful lot of stuff. Yesterday I watched Mission to Mars.
Oh, yeah. Wait, so you watched Domino, right?
I've only watched half of Domino. I was going to watch the second half after this. It's a funny old business. It feels like... I think it's all... Domino's a Brian De Palma film from last year, right? Came out last year.
It's Brian De Palma. It's not the Tony Scott, Keira Knightley movie.
No, this came out in 2019.
Brian De Palma is set in the future of 2020. Now, right? 9th of June.
Yeah. 10th of June. Yes. 9th of June is Mission to Mars.
So 10th of June is today, is it?
Yeah. Today in Wednesday, but if you're listening to this on Friday,
yeah,
and if you listen on the podcast at any time in the future, the past.
It's so weird because when I was watching it, I watched it maybe, I guess it was probably about 6 weeks ago, but even I could have watched it, didn't watch it last week. I could have watched it 2 weeks ago. I could have watched it 3 months ago. I've got no concept of when I watched it, but when I watched it and it was, it said 10th of June and everyone was just driving around Europe willy-nilly, I was thinking, well, there is a chance that this could be accurate, that we're all out by then. And also, I was thinking, it is strange that no one's mentioning COVID. Do you know what I mean? Right. I do think a lot of the conversations will be dictated about... Do you know what I mean? It's just sort of like, what are these main characters, and none of them are ticking off their favourite restaurants that they've missed. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Even if they're back, they're going, nice to be back at work, isn't it? Or they're cops investigating murders, so maybe it's not that nice.
Well, maybe they never had any time off. Maybe that's
them. I guess they were,
But so let's talk about Domino for a little bit, the beginning of Domino.
Yeah.
So he seems to have turned up for work, De Palma.
Yeah. It's like, it feels like, because it's set in Copenhagen as well, it doesn't feel like, I mean, it's low budget for a Brian De Palma movie, but it doesn't feel like it's massively low budget for a European movie, which is kind of what it feels like. It feels like it's a bit of a Euro pudding-y kind of... it's all set in Copenhagen.
Well, like a good comparison to Korea would be if you looked at the Adrian Brody, Dario Argento movie, Giallo.
Right.
Which was, I think that was probably made 15 years ago, mid-2000s, and it was so bad that Adrian Brody sued the production company saying, or sued maybe Dario Argento saying, this is absolutely not what I signed on for. This is one of the worst films I've ever seen. Like, it was, it's terrible. And it's sort of like Dario Argento's decline is kind of, it's sort of mind-boggling. But Brian De Palma, it feels sort of like, it's sort of like almost a companion piece, because again, it's set in a European country, but also the budget has been cut. It's like a tiny budget thing. But I still think that, like, there's that Hitchcock sequence, there's that Vertigo sequence at the beginning when they're going along the rooftop.
Yeah.
He's tried to almost force a Hitchcockian set piece into a movie that doesn't have the budget to sustain those sort of set pieces.
It feels like, I think partly it's set in Copenhagen, it has that sort of feel of a sort of Scandinavian TV crime drama in its look, and it feels fairly like it feels like a sort of TV movie-ish kind of thing, but he is trying to pull things out of the bag with a low budget, and it's sort of remarkable, really, considering that the other, what I think of as a companion piece but aren't, but the other Brian De Palma movie I was watching yesterday, Mission to Mars, was made after Mission Impossible, and obviously has a huge budget, absolutely huge for the time. And that was a film that he signed on to do, like, one of the executives at the studio a favour, because... and it was sort of mad, because what he's done his whole career is he often does a film for the studio, and it's a big hit, and they go, what do you want to do next? And he does a more sort of personal Brian De Palma-y movie.
So he would have done, like, Mission Impossible Studio, and then he would have done Snake Eyes for himself.
Mm.
And then Snake Eyes wasn't really well-regarded, but it was at the time when Nicolas Cage was transitioning from actor to action star.
Yeah. And it did, I think it probably did totally fine. But in that De Palma documentary, it was a thing where apparently, like, when they were making Mission Impossible, like, his agent or whoever asked him to do it was like, Brian, they want you to do this movie. It's a Mission Impossible movie based on a TV show with Tom Cruise. Are you interested in this? And he was like, absolutely, because it's definitely a massive hit. So after that, I can do whatever I like. So he was like, it just sounds like an absolutely tacked on hit. So rather than being at all, like, reserved about doing it, he was all up for it, completely like, I'd love to do Mission Impossible.
Also, it's right in his wheelhouse. Do you know what I mean? It's like a mystery suspense thriller. I mean, you could even take the title Mission Impossible off that first one, and it was, you know, it could be sort of like an espionage thriller. Because it's so far removed from the series. Basically, the series was about a team of people that used to go around doing, you know, solving impossible missions. And even to the point where, like, they was it Peter Graves who was in the original? So I didn't realise this, but John Voight is playing the same character as Peter Graves, and they offered Peter Graves the main villain role to link it to the series, which I think would have cleared up a lot of things.
Yeah, right?
It would have sort of like connected it. But so they offered Peter Graves like the lead in it, and he said, "There's no way I want to be the bad guy." Spoiler alert. So, so then they got John Voight, but I found it really weird that they gave him the same character name, and there was like connected tissue to the either because then what happens is the entire team get killed off, including poor little Emilio Estevez, one of his last big screen outings. A spike through the head.
Yes.
Oof.
I remember when that came out as well in Empire, thinking, oh, Emilio Estevez has done well. He's in this new Mission Impossible film. And I think he's like second lead in the credits, isn't he? They're all quite high up at the start to be a bit of a surprise of what happens. But yeah.
It was unforgivable. But when they made that Sylvester Stallone movie, Bullet to the Head, what was that? That was Walter Hill, and he directed that. Sylvester Stallone, Jason Momoa, Bullet to the Head thing, and Christian Slater's in it. And Christian Slater, you go, oh, good, Christian Slater's... You're watching the trailer. Christian Slater's in a Stallone movie. Good for Christian. Oh, he's been shot in the head in the trailer. In the trailer. And you go, was that Christian Slater that's just been shot in the head in the trailer? Oh, wow. Oh, dear. Oh, dear, oh, dear. But, yeah, I just thought it was... So Mission Impossible is such sort of like a... it takes a lot of liberties with the series to basically take a series and refashion it into a Tom Cruise vehicle.
Yeah.
And they've sort of tried to introduce the team element with sort of like Simon Pegg and Ving Rhames later on in the series. But really, it's just lip service, I think, because it's just...
I think that's it. And I think De Palma was involved in that because when I think he was involved in it in the early stages. And I know he initially developed the script that got thrown out. And the Robert Towne one was brought in by Cruise. But I think the initial script that it was based on was all developed by De Palma. And it was just that. It was just him going, right, it's Mission Impossible. It's a team film, but it can't be a team film. So in order to make this work and make it Tom Cruise vehicle, we need to get rid of the team in the first act. You know, that's the... So that was De Palma's idea, I think.
Barely the first act. It's sort of like the first 5 minutes. And you kind of like, oh, this is what we're doing. But it also feels like there was a lot cut out of the movie... in between the trailer and the film being released. There's sort of like, the trailer sort of suggests that there's this huge romantic subplot that's going on, and then none of that's in the film. But when you compare the transition from Mission Impossible from series to show, to movie, and Man from U.N.C.L.E. from series to movie, Man from U.N.C.L.E. is sort of like it's faithful to the series,
yeah.
Whilst at the same time being like an entirely appropriate update. And yet still being, like, period-specific. Because, obviously, it's sort of got to be about the Cold War. Because it's about an American and a Russian, which is weird. Because the American plays the Russian and the English guy plays the American. It's, I mean, bonkers.
I think the studio is probably interested because The Untouchables was, like, a 50s TV show, wasn't it? So I guess it was the only time they were going, let's have the guy who made this TV show into, like, this really successful, good movie. And let's get him to do Mission Impossible and make that into another, like, top movie. That must have been the thinking, I think.
I watched this online thing that was, like, historically fact-checking movies. And they did, like, they did one on The Untouchables, and they were, like, going through all of the historical inaccuracies between, you know, what happened in history and actually, you know, what Elliot Ness was really like and then what the film was like. And you go, that's absolutely fine. But not once did they mention the fact that the Untouchables movie is based on the TV series The Untouchables. It's condensing an entire plot from it. You know, whatever the character of Elliot Ness was in the TV series is what they're going to do in the movie because it's an adaptation of a fucking series.
Yeah.
But they never mention that. They just like go, well, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. And you go, well, it might be wrong, but I mean, it's what was the series like? You've not mentioned it. So I would just say that is fake news.
Well said.
Yeah. Yeah, really tearing up some of these YouTubers today, I am. That's what I'm in the mood for. Right. So Mission to Mars came out in 1999?
I thought it was 1999, but it all sources point to 2000. So I was like, all right, 2000. Maybe.
Okay. Well, do you know what I'm doing? I'm remembering reading about it before it came out.
Probably.
That's what I'm doing. Submission to Mars came out the same year as...
Sorry?
Submission to Mars came out the same year as Red Planet, right?
It did, yeah.
So which one was Red Planet? Red Planet was Val Kilmer, and Mission to Mars was...
Gary Sinise, Tim Robbins, Don Cheadle, Jerry O'Connell.
And Red Planet was Val Kilmer and Tom Sizemore.
Yeah, and Carrie Ann Moss from The Matrix.
And neither of them were hits, were they?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
Like that classic Hollywood thing where they've made two films about the same thing and they've released them side by side, and one of them's a hit and one of them later on. Like when they did Armageddon and Deep Impact. And Armageddon was obviously a huge hit, but when I watch it, I can't even tell what's going on in it, and it's so long and bloated. Whereas Deep Impact, I think, is really emotional, and I think it works really well as a draw. I watched that years later, and I was like, well, this is the better movie. But there's always sort of like generally a winner. But I remember with the two Mars movies, they kind of like neither of them did that well.
Yeah, I think they were like, I think especially Mission to Mars, I think was a very overblown budget. I mean, it's not a great film. But the kind of set pieces and the special effects are really great. They really stand up. And again, it's like, I was watching some of the extras on the DVD for it, and it was saying that it's all like, you know, they're going, oh, well, that's a model, this shot's a model. And in it, one of the guys says, but it's a model, but it's actually been augmented with CGI. And the guy says, I should say that CGI stands for computer-generated imagery. And I went, wow. They're even having to tell you in 2000, that's what it stands for. It's become such a part of the kind of vocabulary now.
Because it's so weird. It's so, because when we went to see RoboCop, there were those idiots sat behind us.
Oh, yeah.
And they were like going, oh my God, this is proper 1980 CGI. Mm. And you go, no, it's stop motion. CGI is such sort of like a term that people really, I guess people still don't entirely know what it means. They just think it means special effects. Whereas it means, I mean, obviously it means computer-generated imagery, but, like, it's stop motion. RoboCop's got stop... It's beautiful stop motion as well in RoboCop, except for the bit where his arms are all long at the end, but, you know. It's beautiful stop motion.
It shows that 20 years on, that still looks better than CGI, having model shots which have got little bits of CGI to do, like, it's like, yeah, we'll just remove some bits here rather than have everything on screen CGI. It's like, that looks better. It looks more...
People always flag up Ed 209 as sort of bad stop motion. They say, well, you can tell that's stop motion. And I just think, he's a robot. It doesn't matter that he's jerky. I think that it actually adds to it. And also, I really love... I love that you can see the methodology behind how they made the actual shots. Do you know what I mean? It's like you go, yeah. Oh, you know, I don't think King Kong, you know, they famously people always say that you can see like the thumbprints on King Kong when he's being, and you go, I think that adds to it. I think that, you know, because it looks fluid and incredible, and it's like mind-boggling that anyone even worked out how to do that. And I know that CGI is not like a click of a button. It takes hundreds of people, thousands of hours, and like so much money and imagination and creativity to make CGI. I understand that. But there's almost something that's, well, not almost something. There's something more impressive about the thought that it's one or two animators stood around for weeks on end just moving these things a little bit by a little bit.
You're watching a craft rather than you're watching like something someone's tapped into it. It's like when you see those very early like Wallace and Gromits and things, they're a bit more finessed now, but in those very early like 30-minute ones where, yeah, again, you can sort of see like fingerprints on them and it feels like you are like watching like craftsmanship of it's sort of nice to be reminded that there's, you know, Nick Parker or whoever has moved that little thing tiny amounts incrementally. and it's taken him years to put this thing together.
And it adds.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas bad CGI is bad CGI, and it never looks good. And then also, but then again, you can say the same thing about blue screen and green screen. I watched Predator again the other day, and there's a bit when everything in Predator is great. There's a bit right at the beginning when they're just about to jump out the chopper, and it's just this green screen or blue. It's a blue. It would be a blue screen shot. There was this blue screen shot, and it doesn't take you out, but you just think that's awful. Couldn't they have just like hired? Couldn't they have moved like a helicopter into sort of like a garden centre and just had like potted plants as the jungle? Do you know what I mean? It's like there must have been an easier way to do it than. I mean, they were in the jungle.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just think so. It doesn't drag you out of it, but like bad special effects, bad special effects, and so, you know. I watched the thing about the difference between Jurassic Park and Jurassic World, and how the aspect ratio was different in Jurassic Park and Jurassic World. It was mainly about like how people are in awe of the dinosaurs and how we as an audience witness the wonder of living dinosaurs through the eyes of the characters, right? And the aspect, I can't remember what the aspect ratio is, but basically for Jurassic World, the aspect ratio is much wider, yeah? So that when you want to put a dinosaur in the shot, the people, there's less gap between the top and the bottom of the screen. So the dinosaur, let's just say it's Brachiosaurus, it's got a really long neck. So it looks smaller in the middle of the shot because you're trying to get the entire dinosaur in. Mm-hmm. And then the people have to sort of like be bunched up closer to the camera at the bottom. Whereas when you look at the original Jurassic Park, the aspect ratio is sort of like, it's less wide. Yeah, it's less. So it's a less wide shot. So basically you can see the Brachiosaurus more comfortably in the middle of the shot. And then the people are tiny right at the bottom. And it's just like the people are absolutely tiny to the point where you introduce the people walking into the shot. You know, Sam Neill and Nora Dern walk into the shot when they first see it. And then the camera pans. And then this Brachiosaurus, it almost takes up the entire shot. Whereas in Jurassic World, there's huge gaps either side of the screen. So the dinosaur just looks much smaller. Just by the aspect ratio. I just thought that's really interesting because people obviously think that widescreen, as wide as you get is obviously better. But when you look at also stuff like that Christopher Nolan is doing, because he's doing stuff in IMAX, it's not about the width of the shot, it's about the size of the shot.
Yes.
So he's filling, he's almost going back to shooting in square frames. Mm. You know, where he's just filling the shot with so much information. Anyway, I just thought that was quite interesting. Yeah. Anyway.
No, I just think I think that's true. I think that sounds like you've got to do it for what you're making. If it works better in that format, do it in that format. But otherwise, you know, pick your side. That feels like something as well that Spielberg would be all over. Like, I just think it's one of those natural things that he'd be good at.
It's a question that will come up. It'll come up quite early. It's like, what aspect ratio are we shooting in? And then it'll be, and there'll be, and it won't just be kind of like, I think now it's kind of like supply and demand. All of these screens, they're capable of, and I used to think that, you know, the wider the screen, the better the film, you know. Mm. I remember seeing True Lies at the cinema and having to actually turn my head to read the credits because we were like sat so near the front. And that's still a good film. But yeah, I just think that it's not actually about that. It's about what best. Well, you know, when you see something like The Lighthouse, was it The Lighthouse?
Yeah.
That was basically just. And what was the Grand Budapest Hotel used three different aspect ratios to show the different time periods that it was filmed in. So I think that people have thought about it a lot more. And then when people do think about it today, it's almost like a talking point with the film.
Yes.
But now it's sort of like, it's kind of like a studio mandate, which is, right, we're filming in IMAX. We're filming in, you know, Panavision. No one films in Panavision anymore. Anyway, tell me about Mission to Mars.
Well, it was originally like a Gore Verbinski film that he abandoned, and so the studio were kind of needed a director for it. And so the studio called up...
Gore Verbinski from Mouse Hunt.
From Mouse Hunt, it would have been at the time,
before before he did Pirates of the Caribbean and after he did Mouse Hunt.
Yeah.
Right.
So he was going to do Mission to Mars. He pulled out, I think, last minute, and the studio were desperate to find a director. And at the time, post Mission Impossible, and presumably post Snake Eyes, he still had quite a bit of cachet. De Palma, they asked De Palma if he'd do it, and he was reluctant to do it, but did it as a favour, which I think for his mind is probably like a misstep in hindsight, because it's he should have, at the point he was riding high, shouldn't have just done another favour for the studio. He should have done, kept doing his own films for as long as possible. But I think he thought, oh, it's another, probably another tapped on hit. But I think he entered it too late and it didn't really do him any favours in the end. So
it would have been a payday for him, which goes back to the John Lydon thing, isn't it? Which is sort of like you do something for the money and then you can take a risk later on. I think if you have like three flops in a row, then you're kind of like dead in Hollywood.
Yeah.
But if you can kind of like have a hit and then a flop and then, like say, do another studio thing. So what were you saying there was the flop before? What gave him cachet, actually, before?
Things like The Untouchables allowed him to do Casualties of War, I think, was it, that came straight after? And in the, what was the early ones? I know that, what was before? There was something before Blowout, I think, as well. Or I think for a while, actually, he was having hit after hit. And then Blowout was his first one that really tanked, I think.
When was Carrie? Because Carrie was fucking huge, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's 77.
So that when Blowout was 80, so but he was just knocking them out back then. Mm. But they were low-budget indie films, you know? Well, it felt like they were. And then when he did Carrie, it was just sort of like, now he's in the same league as Spielberg, you know?
Yeah, he was, I think, at that time.
And then he did Scarface. Was Scarface a hit?
Oh, yeah, massive, I think, yeah.
That De Palma documentary is incredible.
It really is, and it is just a setup of... Oh, Carrie was 76, apparently. Yeah, and it is. It's just him talking. It's a camera set up on him, telling him about...
Carrie's 76 because fucking Brian De Palma and George Lucas shared the casting sessions, didn't they? So yes. They were like... They had one office and... half the cast ended up being in Carrie and the other half of the cast ended up being in Star Wars.
Yeah.
So it makes sense because there'd have been less special effects for Carrie to be 76. But that's how you do it back at home, guys. If you compare it up with another film that was made around the same time, then you can work out what the, you know, it's not a magic trick. We're just using logic, you know. You go, right, so George Lucas and Brian De Palma, they shared a casting session with Carrie and Star Wars. So Carrie probably would have had less special effects. That's 76, and Star Wars was famously 1977, and that's how you work it out. And then when people get confused about when Star Trek came out, you go, oh, Star Trek clearly came out 2 years after Star Wars, because that's how much time, was it 2 years? Was it 79?
79, yeah.
Same year as Alien, obviously, and Moonraker. You know, because these films were all sort of like Star Wars influenced, you know. But me and Nat talk about Brian De Palma all the time, and if you're kind of like trying to get into Brian De Palma, I think, I'm not even sure if it's the best place to start. I would say start with something like Blowout, Untouchables, Mission Impossible is kind of like a mainstream Brian De Palma film. And then I would, Phantom of the Paradise is a weird film, but it's a good film. And then I've watched a documentary and then I just fill up all the gaps because I just think that he is, he's just absolutely, he's an incredible director. And the things that get me most excited are like the 70s, early 80s stuff that he did. Or Untouchables, which is sort of like mid-late 80s. But those films are just all brilliant. They're like a continuation of Hitchcock, you know. Really good.
there's a lot of that in it. I suppose that's probably what, again, was the idea in Mission Impossible, to kill off the team at the start. For him was probably like, well, that's the ultimate sort of psycho move, to have all these other, every other character, including, you know, Kristin Scott Thomas, Emilio Estevez, and basically the team that have been advertised as being the sort of second and third leads, have everyone else killed off. Act one.
That's the psycho manoeuvre, right? Yeah. That's what we call it as well. We call it the psycho manoeuvre. It's like the Holdo manoeuvre from The Last Jedi. People say, you can't do that, and they did. And then the whole universe falls apart. Anyway, Mission to Mars, how much would you give it out of £11?
Give it £6.50.
Oh, so it's not bad.
It's not bad. It's just very, like, the dialogue's really corny. It's like sort of really like, it almost, when you're watching it, it feels like you're going to watch a much worse film than it is. It's trying to do like a 2001 in a very mainstreamy 2000 for like, very mainstreamy 2001, sort of a bit metaphysical, but not clever enough. But it's all right. It's got quite a classy cast. And as I say, the set pieces are great. And all the special effects are really good, like really impressive.
And it's set today on June the 10th.
It's set on June 9th. The first bit is, then the rest of it's set a couple of years later.
Domino is set June the 10th. And, okay, well, that's free. Did you watch it because of this?
I thought, oh, I'll watch Mission to Mars. It's set. Oh, that's set now. And I think you'd said the other week that Domino was set about now. Yeah. So I was going, when's that set? And I looked it up and it's like, it's set the day after. What a weird coincidence.
That is weird. It's probably unintentional.
Yeah. And in no bits
of it. Is it? Because Domino was filmed last year, or maybe 2018. It's like, why would you set something? Why not just set it present day rather than 1 year in the future?
No idea.
But how slowly it takes for films to get released and to spread around. And we've got to play a song, but it's weird. Join us again after this track.
We all got a long way to go.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Okay, so I had an interesting experience this week where what I've been doing is I occasionally I'll watch like a film with someone over the internet where I'll like WhatsApp them, do a video call on WhatsApp, and then I've moved my because I still my Sky still isn't. I mean, it's been since December. What's that? 7 months I haven't had Sky.
You're still paying for it.
I can basically say I'm not a Sky customer anymore, right?
So,
just please, just someone, if anyone is listening, please, the internet stopped working in my bedroom. And that sounds like a masturbation problem, but it's not. It's I just like watching YouTube in bed, and fucking hell, the technology in my house is slowly just sort of like making my life miserable. Like bit by bit, it's shutting down. So I moved my desktop into my living room so that I could watch films on sort of like a fairly normal size screen. And so I've got Netflix on my desktop. So, and the other day I was talking to a friend and we were looking for something to watch on Netflix, but it takes ages to find anything. And then all of a sudden Terminator came up. And they were like, I've not seen Terminator. And I was like, you've not seen Terminator? And I was like, okay, well, shall we watch Terminator? So we watched Terminator. And in my head, I've always thought Terminator is, I think I've always sort of slightly preferred it to Terminator 2, and I don't know why that is. But I watched it, we watched it, and like about 10 minutes in, they were like, hang on a minute, is Arnold Schwarzenegger the bad guy? And I was like, yeah, he's the Terminator. In Terminator, he's a bad guy. And their mind was sort of like blown. They were like, oh God. And I said, have you seen Terminator 2? And they were like, no, I've not seen Terminator 2. I said, do you know anything about Terminator 2? They said, I don't know anything about the Terminator films. And I was like, oh my God. This is absolutely mind-blowing to me, right? So we watched Terminator. Terminator is sort of like a slasher movie that is framed with sort of like a cyberpunk kind of aesthetic where there's an unstoppable killer like Jason or Michael Myers, and he's hunting down this woman, and all these other women called Sarah Connor are also getting murdered. And it just becomes like, it's just basically, it's a chase movie, right? And it's good, it's a thriller, and for what it is, it's kind of like, it holds up pretty well as sort of a thriller, but then we watch Terminator 2, and it's difficult to know what to do with the Terminator franchise in terms of introducing it to someone, right? Because Terminator 2... Famously with all the Terminator movies, there's always sort of like a major plot twist in all the Terminator movies, but it always gets spoiled in the first trailer for every single Terminator film, right? So in Terminator Genesis, John Connor's in it, but they reveal in the trailer that John Connor is a Terminator now, right? And in Terminator Salvation, it was like, oh, Sam Worthington's in it. But they reveal in the trailer that Sam Worthington is a Terminator, right? And it's kind of like, there's like very little. And I was just going to assume that everyone has seen Terminator 2. But the thrill of watching Terminator 2 with someone that doesn't know that Arnold Schwarzenegger is the good guy, because they gave it away in the trailer, right? So you're watching it, they've watched Terminator, they go, right, Arnie's a bad guy. There's the bit when they go to the Galleria shopping centre, not the one in Hatfield, but the one in Los Angeles. And they go to the Galleria shopping centre.
He's got a bunch of flowers.
With a bunch of flowers, Guns N' Roses. And Arnold Schwarzenegger's hunting down John Connor. T-1000 is hunting down John Connor. And then they're like in a back corridor and they both confront each other. And at that point, you don't know who is who. One of them's a police officer, and one of them's Arnold Schwarzenegger, the bad guy from the first film. And they get their guns out, and John Connor's in the middle, and you think, oh my, they play it like it's a twist, right? But the marketing just completely just threw all that out the window, and was just like, nah, it's not real. It's 40 minutes into the film or something where you don't know who the good guy is. And there's essentially there's two guys that are hunting this kid. And they play it like it's a twist, but none of the marketing supported that. So I'm watching it with this friend, and they're watching it, and their mind is absolutely fucking blown. And it's just, it was sort of like, oh, it was just as much of a thrill watching their face as it was watching them. And then you get to the end of the film and you go, there's no comparison. Terminator 2, I would say my favourite Arnold Schwarzenegger film is Predator. And I've always sort of like thought that Terminator 2 is probably a little bit too long and a little bit too worthy. On the one side, they're saying all violence is bad. And on the other side, they're just blowing stuff up. It's like they're having their cake and eating it a bit. So it's a bit hypocritical, but I think the message is really good. But also, I just think, yeah, I haven't seen it in such a long time all the way through. I was crying at the end. I was crying all the way through it. I was just like, it's such a stunning film. But now we're in the quandary of what you watch next. Do you watch Terminator 3 and Terminator Salvation? And then Terminator Genesis sort of ignores Terminator 3 and Terminator Salvation. So then do you skip to Terminator Genesis instead of Terminator 3 and Terminator 4? Or do you skip right to Terminator, what's the last one called?
Who knows anymore? Dark Fate?
Dark Fate, Terminator. I haven't seen Dark Fate. I thought it looked... Yeah. And also, they leaked the plot twist for that, and I was kind of like, oh, I don't know if I really want to watch that. But it's essentially Terminator. So they've made like three Terminator 3s. Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, Terminator Genesis, and Terminator Dark Fate all act as Terminator 3s. And this last one was the one where James Cameron comes back, and it's kind of like, no, this is the definitive. He didn't direct it. He sort of like was part of the story, but was it Tim Miller that did Deadpool? He came back. He came on board and did it. And it's quite funny because Ryan Reynolds was basically fell out with Tim Miller, and Tim Miller wanted to take Deadpool 2 in a different direction, and then Ryan Reynolds didn't agree, so Tim Miller left, and he went on to do Terminator. Ryan Reynolds made some sort of a joke about like, oh, what was he going to do with Deadpool 2? Do another action sequence on a bridge? And then the trailer for Terminator Dark Fate was this huge action sequence on a bridge. And basically that sort of Tim Miller's ace up his sleeve is, I'll set it on a bridge and then we'll do... Because you can't really get off a bridge, can you? I think that's maybe the thinking. But I haven't seen it yet. So it would kind of like be like a first time for me and a first time for them. But it's sort of like this weird... What? Yeah. So I'm basically throwing that out there.
Do you know what? I've only ever seen Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, and that is the last Terminator film I saw. I haven't seen any of the others.
Yeah.
And I did like... I quite like Terminator 3, but it feels like it's... You know, it feels already like... You're on a sliding scale then. And after that, I was quite happy, and I thought, well, that seems to wrap things up fine. As does the second one. I don't think you need to see any more after two. I think you could go, that's the end.
Yeah, I think that that's possibly it. I think that, because they're just... And in a way, the first film kind of... You sort of don't even need the first film. You can just sort of watch the second film and go... Because the second film builds so much on the first film in terms of taking everything to the next level that... They don't really flow that well together because there's sort of inconsistencies. So you just like go, well, like Terminator 2 has most of the iconic stuff. Terminator 1 has got some really cool kind of like early 80s horror, sci-fi, action. some really great stop motion special effects. You know, there's, you know, it's got some stuff in it, but basically everything comes together, looks incredible in Terminator 2. Arnold Schwarzenegger's look in it is sort of like established right from the beginning, and you go, right, okay, this is...
Oh, yeah, like Terminator versus Terminator 2. Terminator is also like a low-budget movie, really, versus Terminator 2, which is a massive budget movie.
The biggest budget film of its time at the time. I think it was 100 million or maybe 120 million. And then Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines. There's some people stand by it, but their only argument seems to be it's got a good ending. And you go, yeah, it's got a good ending. It looks like a pilot for the Terminator TV, like a sci-fi channel Terminator TV series. It looks so cheap. And it wasn't. It was Arnold Schwarzenegger's last film before he became governor.
And so, $1 million, right?
He can work out whether he should do it. And then he said to James Cameron, should I, because James Cameron wasn't involved by that point. And he said, should I do it? And James Cameron just said, just take the money. Ask for as much as possible and then take the money and then do it. So he got 30 million for it. And then he was governor. And it was sort of like his last probably huge hit. I think it's awful. It's unwatchable. It's like a parody movie. And then Terminator Salvation I thought was okay, but like as soon as you leave, you start like questioning everything. Like they've got, you know, we've talked about it before, but they've got these 50-foot-tall robots that have got arms and legs and heads. And you go, why? The Terminator is an infiltration unit that's meant to look like a human. It's a, you know, 6-foot-tall. It looks like it's got a skeleton and then it's got like human flesh on the outside. It's meant to look like a human so that it can why have you built a robot with arms and legs and a head that's 50 foot tall that shoots motorbikes out of its wrists? Why have they got motorbikes? They can fly. Like you know, you watch it and you go, that's sort of okay. And then afterwards, it just all falls apart. And then Terminator Genesis is just kind of, I kind of like the idea they tried to do a Back to the Future 2, where, oh, we'll set the sequel within the first movie. But the guy, Jai Courtney, doesn't look anything like Michael Biehn. And then it's just kind of like, it's like they've really picked and chosen what they're going to stick with and what they're not going to stick with. And they just don't flow. And anyway, it's just rubbish. I know it's rubbish. But Dark Fate, I'm really not. I think that you probably don't ever need to watch another one. But I'm just saying, it was a special moment watching it through the eyes of basically someone that has lived in a nuclear bunker, ironically. Someone from the nuclear bunker at the end of Terminator 3 has never seen any of the Terminator movies and is now watching them for the first time. There you go.
Just want to say as well that before when you were talking about, you know, that's how you work out what year films came out of, I think that's a good message, Nick, because I'm sure there's lots of people that listen to this that we're sort of big heroes to them, and they probably think us being able to name the year of films that came out 30, 40 years ago is like a sort of superpower. But I think you explaining that and explaining how we do it in our heads and how we work it out just lets them know that we're just human too. We're just real people. And we're just human,
you know. Yeah. Terminator, same year as Ghostbusters, a year before Back to the Future, 1984. Terminator 2, the year after Total Recall, 1991. Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, just after university, 2003. Terminator Salvation, 2007, 2008. I was doing Perfect Movie. And then fucking Terminator Dark Fate, 2019. When was Genesis? Who gives a fuck? Right. So, fan mail. Play that funky music, white boy. Hi. I think I've fallen in love during lockdown. I have fallen in love with your show and your husky Sims voices. I would like them as an alarm clock. I find you both super delicious. What is your alarm clock? Do you like the films of Ronald Reagan? Chubba Chub, dear Nick. And
oh,
right, Chubba Chub. That's Chubba Chub.
Do
you like the films of Ronald Reagan?
What's it? Bedtime for Bunzo.
doesn't like Bedtime for Bonzo? Lot of fun. Lot of fun. That's it.
That's it.
He made westerns, didn't he? I don't know. What's my alarm clock? My alarm clock is the most stressful sound. I think it's Sonar or something like that that you get on Apple. And it's fucking... It's that. And then randomly, I've got Touch Too Much from AC/DC, which really sort of like kicks in very loud and hard, which is also terrifying. And then I also have... what's it? It's one of the songs off of High Fidelity. Will somebody please help me with my misery? That song. Sad. So I just wake up. If I wake up, I'm either waking up scared, angry, or sad. I should change them. have you got an alarm clock, Nat?
I just have the one that comes with Apple. I used to have one that was like a sort of one that was meant to wake up really calmly. And I just got rid of it. It just has exactly the same effect, where it was like sort of almost like kind of little kind of like almost like wind chimey kind of sound. But then that just ends up having exactly the same effect, because you just associate the alarm clock with having to get up. So after a day or two, that even that sound is like, oh, that's horrible.
Yeah.
Off.
I'm tending not to use an alarm clock in lockdown. I wake up at 6 p.m. Scared, annoyed, and angry with myself. And who needs? That's what an alarm clock does for me. So all I can do is just sort of like waste days. Dear Nick and Matt, I hope you are safe and well. I really need your opinion on this. Do you think that forcing my boyfriend to watch Downton Abbey makes me a terrible girlfriend? Let me know what you think, Amy. Never seen it. I've never seen it. I was up for watching the film on a boat once, but apart from that, no.
I've never seen it. I've heard it's a quite kind of, it's a bit like Upstairs, Downstairs, but a bit more like, a bit more pro the rich people. So I'm not really
confident. What's that Robert Altman film?
Yeah, that's, what's that called? It's got a really similar title as well, isn't it?
Gosford Park. Hey, Gosford Park! I would just watch Gosford Park, and if he doesn't like that, then don't subject him to the TV series.
Although yeah, Gosford Park is the same writer as well, isn't it? But it's a good film, Gosford Park.
Yeah, but wasn't Gosford Park improvised?
Maybe.
It's Robert Altman, isn't it?
Yeah, it probably was.
That's his thing. Hi, boys, just letting you know that I had a dream about Nick Helm the other night. He was a lead singer in a circa 2005 indie rock band. Got into trouble for starting a mosh pit at a Princess Diana memorial gig. Gavin Slow. That's a weird dream. Something I would never do. Hi, lads. Snog, marry, avoid. Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, or Goofy? Jethro. Who would you snog? Who would you marry? Who would you avoid? Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, or Goofy? Tempted to
probably avoid Mickey Mouse. No, I wouldn't. No, hang on. No, it's hard, isn't it?
I think that you would like Goofy.
Yeah, I think you'd like him.
I think that that after a while, he would just keep knocking over pints of water all over your living room floor, and you'd just be like, and you'd just be, I just can't be dealing with it. I can't be doing, no. So I would probably avoid Goofy. I'd probably kiss Donald. I'd probably get off. I've never got off with, like, a cartoon character, but I have once got off with a duck, and that was nice. So maybe, and I've fucked a mouse. So maybe I would marry Mickey. I would get off with Donald Duck. But I'd probably avoid Goofy because I might fall in love with him, but at the end of the day, I think he would just be frustrating.
I think that's the right answer. I think that's the correct answer.
Hi, lads! I watched the Super Mario Bros. Movie the other day. It's awful! Who would you cast as Mario and Luigi if you were making it today? I would cast Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo, but John Leguizamo as Mario... And Bob Hoskins as Luigi.
I remember once going to see... Like, I went to see that at the Barking Odeon when it came out. And we got there...
That's
there was a little bit
barking!
We got there. There was a bit of a queue to get in. And as we were queuing up, like, well, it's quite popular, Super Mario Brothers. And I was like, yeah, I'm surprised, really. I sort of thought, I kind of think the film will be rubbish. And my mate said to me, I think it's going to be rubbish as well. Shall we not go? And we went, yeah, let's not go. And we have never seen it. Never seen it.
I saw it in the cinema. It's rubbish. It's rubbish. But it's the first of its kind, isn't it? But like Bob Hoskins famously, right up until the end of his days, was saying, there's one fucking film that he hates, and it's Super Mario Brothers. Who would you cast as Mario?
Would you try and get someone...
You get, like, Danny DeVito.
Or someone like Danny McBride?
Danny McBride? Oh, maybe Danny McBride would be quite good, but he's not Italian, is he?
No.
But what was the first person you said? Ian McKellen?
No,
I'd get Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart to be...
Yeah, I'd watch that.
You sound like a gaggle of schoolgirls. Well, that's the problem. There's a giant turd blocking up your toilets. Make it flush. Yeah, because they're plumbers. And then they're
going to be good. That would be good.
Here's the last one. Hi, Nick and Nate. Love the show. I really fancy a bacon cheeseburger. Should I have one? They do tend to give me a runny... Oh, come on. But I could just sit on the commode all day tomorrow. Best Meryl. Fill your boots. So... Thanks for the fan mail this week. It makes us feel real special to know that so many out there are appreciating the content and the show that we're putting out there during lockdown. Let's play a song and then we'll get... Stanley Tucci would be good.
He would be
and
good.
And our guest is waiting in the waiting room. Okay, so let's play a song and then talk to our guest.
Yes. Well, we know where we're going, but we don't know.
Seen, and we're not little children, and we know what we want, and the future is certain. Give us time to work it out. Take a matter.
Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back in the studio with is that me and there's Nathaniel Metcalf, and we're joined in the studio by poet, producer, writer, TV writer. I mean, you've done Henry Normal. We're joined in the studio by living legend Henry Normal.
Usually, by the time somebody's introduced me, I'm sick of myself.
Yeah, but well, prepare to get sick of yourself then, I suppose. Thank you for coming on to our show. How are you doing? You all right?
All right, thanks. Yeah, yeah. I've not been out for a few months, but apart from that, you know, all right.
Have you not been out at all?
Not really, no. No, yeah, just around the block, you know, doing a bit of a walk.
That's all right.
That's it, yeah, you know. Where is there to go?
Do you live near the beach?
I do, yeah, yeah. So I can't turn you around at the minute, but basically, if you're around the other way, you'd see the sea. So we overlook the sea. Me and my lad, you know, my lad's autistic, so he's about 22. We go a walk round just by the beach and come back up, and that's it. That's our little tour.
You're in Brighton?
Yeah, Brighton.
Lovely, lovely.
Because you used to be the head of Baby Cow, yes. And then you retired to go back to gigging as a poet. And so you must enjoy the sort of change of pace.
I do enjoy the change of pace. I thought once we'd done the third series of Uncle, I thought I'd peaked. So there's little left for me to do. I do enjoy it, actually. The great thing, you'll know this, when you do television, you've got lots and lots of people. And so everything's being pulled this way and that. Whereas if you create something and it's just you, and you do a live show or you do a Zoom like this, you know, there's less people. So it's a sort of a purer bit of art form, isn't it?
Yeah. Although,
I don't think of this as art.
I would hate people to judge me. I'd hate people to judge my life based on this podcast.
Yeah, but the great thing, actually, I've seen you live, and I know when you're standing up there live, it's just you, and same with you, Nathaniel, it's just you and the audience, and what you say is, nobody's telling you to say this or say that, just you and the audience. So it's as pure as you can get. You take a film like Philomena. So we had about 300 people working on Philomena. So when you look at the art department and you look at the costumes department, everybody's just changing the image in your head slightly. So that by the time you've actually made the thing, it's not the image that was in the writer's head, shall we say. Whereas I think something like this is brilliant. You know, I mean, this is just us, isn't it? Just three blokes talking.
I concede the point, but Philomena was also a very good film. It'd be a better example if it was a real pudding.
Yeah, but it made over 150 million, which is probably more than most Zooms, I would imagine.
So, a little bit of context was, yeah. I was doing a show called, me and Nat, we grew up watching Steve Coogan on TV, and I'll go into some of that stuff later, but basically, one of the all-time greatest DVD extras on anything, like film, anything that I've ever had. One of the ones that I always go back to is the writing room DVD extra that you did for Cheese and Ham, Paul and Pauline.
Oh,
Cash.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah. Not many people mention that, Nick, to be honest with you. You know, it's not up there with the... But thank you, I enjoyed that.
So Cheese and Ham Sandwich was basically Steve had done Live and Lewd, and he'd done The Man Who Thinks He's It.
Yeah, the tour, both tours, yeah.
The Man Who Thinks He's It, I think, is which you co-wrote, right?
That's right, and Peter Bain and myself, Steve. And, of course, there was Simon Pegg and Julia Davis were on the show, and they wrote their bits.
So The Man Who Thinks He's It, if people haven't seen it, you should see it. It's one of the, I think, at the time, one of the all-time best live DVD videos that I ever owned. And I watched it maybe 30 times, to the point that I would find lines from it going into my stand-up while I was on stage. I go, don't say that. That's from The Man Who Thinks He's It. And it was sort of like a variety show where Steve would bring out all of his characters. He did like Paul, Pauline, Tony Farino, Duncan Thicket, who's probably one of my favourite characters, and Alan Partridge. And then when BBC Three launched as a channel, you did a sort of half-hour special where Steve did Pauline Calf and then Paul Calf, and then in between he was compared on and off by Duncan Thicket.
That's right.
Duncan Thicket is the worst stand-up comedian on the planet.
Duncan Thicket was Steve's first character. So right. When I met Steve when he was 19, that was the only character he had. So he would do all the usual impressions that impressionists do, and was quite mainstream. But the one thing that he did that was beyond mainstream was Duncan Thicket. So when I met him, he asked me to write with him, and we wrote a pilot, which has never been on, for Duncan Thicket, about Duncan Thicket being a bus conductor. But they'd thrown him off the bus conducting, and it was called Empty Up Top.
Did you film it?
No, we wrote it. And do you know what? We had such a time writing it. Because basically, what we'd do, Steve would come over to my house, and he'd come in his Porsche, and he'd bring some milk. So I had the fastest milkman in Manchester. And we'd sit down, and we would just think, what can we do to basically make this person's life a misery? And we would howl laughing at the sort of the awful things that we would do to the character. And it's still one of my favourite scripts, but it's never been made.
I also think if you're Steve Coogan and you're sort of branching out and trying to do sort of new form character stand-up, that if your first character is the worst stand-up in the world, it's like bulletproof. Bulletproof, because you can almost go out there and be terrible, but also you've got that shield between you and the audience of
and he lasted quite a long time, actually, because he's been on, as you say, several incarnations, and we used to love trying to think what was the modern thing that was happening in comedy, and then we would get him to do it wrong.
And so like self-deprecating comedy.
Sorry?
A lot of comedians are into self-deprecation. I'm a right cunt, me.
You know, I love the fact you remember that, because that's one of my gags. So, it's always good.
And then he goes, and that's something everyone can relate to. Well, he can. And then he points, it's amazing. But then, so when BBC Three launched, you did sort of like a half-hour special, and I bought it on DVD.
And that was actually the first show on BBC Three.
That's what I thought it was, yeah. And so I bought it on DVD, and then on the extras of the DVD, there's sort of like a making-of documentary. And when I started out writing comedy, I mean, I'd written a few Edinburgh shows up to then, so I think I probably saw it in about 2004 or 2005. When I started writing comedy, there's a DVD extra, which is basically you and Steve have hired out like a hall.
Yeah.
And you're basically, Steve sat one side of the table with the camera facing him, and you're behind the camera. Yeah. And you're sat at this table and you're just writing jokes together. And you're sort of like just improvising stuff out loud. And it's sort of like this real back and forth between you. And you can see the jokes evolve as you're going, and then you see the final show and you go, that's the joke that they just came up with. And as a writer, it was sort of like this invaluable kind of like resource where you'd sort of like watch it and you go, well, that's how they did it. So it's not like, it's sort of like demystified the process.
I'm glad it did, yeah. Because anyway, I mean, I had some of the greatest fun. So I worked with Carolina Hearn as well, and Craig Cash and Dave Gorman, as well as Graham Duff and Steve. And I've had some of the best fun ever, just sat in a room thinking up jokes, some of which nobody's ever heard because we thought of a funnier one. And so we didn't do the original. And you'll probably notice from that, what I used to do is I used to think up a joke. And it'd be quite a short joke because it'd just be basically like a, you know, a nub of a joke. But it would be the central sort of twist of it. And then Steve would elongate it and just give it a rhythm and make it bigger. And so the laugh was bigger. And I used to love that about him. And I learned a lot from him in terms of the way you take the nub of a joke, but you expand it. And by giving it such weight, when you actually get to, even if, thanks, Ange. Ange just creeping in with my cup of tea. By giving it such weight, when you get to the nub of it, it just explodes and it makes it better. Steve was always great for that. And very often we would write jokes where it would be a joke that neither of us had written because we couldn't have written it without the 7 backwards and forwards. Always in the Mrs. Merton show when we were writing, people would ask us who wrote a joke, especially that one, what first attracted you to the millionaire, Paul Dent. And we could never remember because there's 4 of us in the room. And you'd talk for about 10 minutes before you got to that joke. And so anybody's contribution could have been in it.
But it's sort of like capturing lightning and bottle. It's those it's like a perfect storm of people that are in the room that are creating that thing. And if you took an element out of it, you'd get a different result, you know?
Yeah, I loved it. And I love the pressure of it because I used to write for Caroline and Steve at the same time. So I'd write nights and weekends and everything. And, as a young man, it was like a fairground ride. I was just, buzzing from it. And I always remember Steve came, we used to write Saturday Zoo. So Paul Carf was on Saturday Zoo first. And he came in one day and said to us, I'm going to write Pauline Carf. And I said, who the hell's Pauline Carf? He says, well, it's Paul Carf's sister. I said, "Oh, right. Well, we've got about 2 days to write this." I said, "What do you know about her?" And the only thing he'd come up with so far was, "She says dead sophisticated." So we started from that basis that she was slightly trying to be pretentious. You know, if you think about all the books that she wrote and stuff like that, but she was common as muck.
But so all of the Saturday Zoos are extras on the Cheese and Ham Sandwich DVD. So I just, this is a coincidence, right? So it seems like a setup, but I've got
all right, yeah,
a copy of Paul's book for boys and Pauline's book for girls here. Yeah. I was wondering if you could sign it for me.
I'll tell you a funny story about that. So when we were writing that, Steve was trying to do about 3 things at the same time. So I think he was in a film and stuff like that. So I'd have to wake him up to write it. So he'd lie on my floor and he'd go to sleep and then I'd wake him up for a bit and then we'd write a bit and then he'd go back to sleep again. So whenever I see that, that's what I always remember, him actually asleep on my floor.
Do you feel like going back to like performance poetry, does that feel like a bit of a course correction? Do you feel like you were taken away from it into this big kind of media, showbiz, TV producing world? And does it feel like going back to it feels like this is what I should have been doing all along?
Well, you can't make any money from poetry. So, I've got a wife and a child, so you've got to pay the rent. Most poets have another job. Luckily I had a job that paid well and was lots of fun. I got to work with loads of great people. But I do sometimes think if I'd have, because I'm a big friend of Lem Sisse, who's now a world poet. And I think if I'd have stuck at it, would I have got any prestige as a poet? I wouldn't have got any money. But, there's more to life than money. I think old Nicky is a great poet when he wants to be. And I think there's something about poetry that is over and above comedy. And funnily enough, I talked to Steve recently, and you notice a lot of comedians, as they get older, they move more into drama. And I think you're looking for something a bit more substantial. Now, I love comedy to bits, but it is a bit like sugar. Do you know what I mean? It's good to make things, you know, give things flavour and make them sweet and you know. But to actually put over a message and to have something substantial, you want to have something there. If you just eat sugar, it's a bad diet. I love comedy as a vehicle to say other things. And with poetry, you can do that. So that's great. Whether it be a short ditty or whether it be a huge magnum opus.
Well, it's easier to. Having said that, most of my favourite films are comedies.
Yeah.
But I think that when something is just, especially with stand-up, I think when something is just about jokes, if that is the style that you pick for your stand-up, then it's sort of like, not that it's disposable, but once you've heard the punchline, you sort of want new, you know, you ingest it, do you know what I mean? And so it's kind of like you're on to the next laugh. But when you attach something that's more dramatic to it, then it sort of like gives it a bit more weight, and then the comedy is sort of like working counterbalance to it.
I think so. I think it's some of my favourite films. So I've seen Midnight Run 33 times, and I love that film, and I love the big laughs in it, and I cry every time his daughter offers him money at the car. Because it's got the saddest scene, and it's got some of the happiest scenes, and the funny bits are funnier because the sad bits are so sad.
Well, so one of the first times, so I think what happened was because I'd sort of like watched all of this stuff about, you know, the making of cheese and ham sandwich and all that, and obviously you're in Live and Lewd. At the beginning, and so I was very aware of who you were, and I remember that I came out on stage in 2011 in Edinburgh, and you were sat on the front row at the side, and I literally was just like, oh fucking hell, that's Henry Normal. And I was just like, I had to do the show knowing who you were, that you were right there, and I was thinking, oh no. And then Channel 4 basically said, we want you to do these blaps. Who do you want to work with? And I was like, well, I want to work with Baby Cow. And I don't think you'd done loads of stuff with Channel 4 at that point.
No.
It was a bit of a weird thing. But then after I'd done the blaps, I think me and Josh Widdicombe and Henry Packer came in for a meeting with you. And we were talking about what your favourite film was. And we said, I can't remember who asked, but you said, my favourite film is Falling Down.
Yeah.
I've seen it 17 times. And I said, how do you know you've seen it 17 times? And he said, because every time I watch it, I take it out of the video player and I put it down and I go, that's 17.
I was just about to ask you the same thing about Midnight Run.
You've got to keep altering the number, otherwise, you're going to put it down. I just love those films. There's something, you know what, they both got something in common, aren't they? Basically, they're both a damaged central character. There's something redemptive about films that I don't know why. It's not like anything's ever happened in my life that's been so bad. But I think there's a thing with all comedians. This is my theory, and every comedian I've ever come across has got a version of this. So my mum died when I was 11, right? So I then became very withdrawn, and everybody that I've spoke to has got something that's happened in their childhood or in their teens or in their early 20s where they've stepped back from life, and instead of being the centre of attention, they sort of try and work out how it all works and why it all works. And you know, when you see Glastonbury and everybody jumping up and down in Glastonbury, no writers in jumping up and down. They're all at the side trying to work out why these people are jumping up and down. And I think there's the part of what we do creatively is this trying to reconnect with that that naive person that didn't want to work it all out. And you know, I think in a way, if you satisfy that, you probably won't create. So luckily, we won't.
I think this. Yeah, I think that I relate to that a lot. I think there is something like where you kind of, you sort of step back in your teenage years and you just watch other people and see how it's going. And I remember at school, I was never like the class clown, but there was another kid who was. And sometimes I'd watch him and go, yeah, I thought of that as well, before he'd say something. Yeah, I thought of that one. And I'd sort of go, and then I'd almost be thinking, you should have also said this. Yeah. That would have been funny. But you're just sort of watching it happen.
Yeah, I was in class clown. I was quite withdrawn. I met the first comedian I ever met. I used to do a disco for old people when I was about 16. I had a record player, and my mate said to me, "Can you come and do this old people's disco?" So, because I had a record player, so we'd because they were so old, we'd put some of the records that were 45 on 33, so they could dance to them. And at Christmas, they hired a comedian, and this comedian came, and he went off stage. He weren't funny at all. And I remember looking at him thinking, oh, you're going to die on that stage. And of course, he was saving it all for when he went on the stage. And then when he went on the stage, I always remember his first joke, because he got shorts on and he was dressed like a kid, a bit like Angus from AC/DC. Hey. And he went on stage and he said, "Me mum asked me what I want for Christmas. And I said, I want something to wear and something to play with. So she gave me these shorts with an hole in the pocket. that was over 40 odd years ago, I remember. But what I really remember was the fact that he wasn't trying to be a pain in the arse off stage. He was just saving it and doing his thing on stage. And most comedians I've come across, they're not trying to be funny all the time.
If you go back to like the very early days then, so when were you always a performance poet, or were you writing before you'd ever kind of say it out loud?
Well, I used to write bits at school in the style of Monty Python. So I was a big Monty Python, and then Spike Milligan. And then I read a book by Spike Milligan called Small Dreams of a Scorpion. And there was a particular poem in this book that made me cry. And I remember thinking, somebody that can make me laugh so much, and Spike Milligan, I used to have tears in my eyes when I'd read Spike Milligan, and he can make me cry. And I thought, I love that. I love that he can do both. And so I was drawn into that idea of the, and it's quite a lovely composite form, the poem. And so that's when I got hooked. And then I saw Roger McGough one lunchtime when I was about 19. And he read Summer with Monica, which is basically, sort of a love poem. And I thought, you know, I was trying to cop off at that time. I thought that might be useful. So I wrote a load of love poems. And then I saw John Cooper Clarke at the Leadmill. And he was wearing sunglasses and it was inside. And I thought, this man is cool. This man is so cool. There's about 400 people in the Leadmill. It was absolutely packed. And he was reading off a bit of paper. And I thought, well, I can read off a bit of paper. I mean, you know, I give it a go. I think 30 quid the first time I actually got paid. And I thought, well, this is better than working. I was an insurance broker at the time. This is per 10 minutes, this is better paid than working. So yeah. All you've got to do is, you know, get as many gigs as you can.
Was that it? So where were you gigging in those early days? So you were doing...
First gig I ever did was in Nottingham, because I'm from Nottingham. It was a place called Spots Cabaret. You've got to remember, back then, there was no comedy clubs. Certainly in the north, there were no comedy clubs. I know in London, alternative comedy was just about starting, but in the north, it wasn't. So you'd have to go to jazz clubs and folk clubs. And I was on with things like, remember once being on at the Stockport Town Hall with can-can dancers. And so I was on with one way everything. I used to tour with Pulp when I was in Chesterfield, and lots of the Chesterfield and Sheffield bands. So basically any platform. I remember with Linda Smith once, we went to this gig, and the actual stage was just it was a mattress. And we had to stand on this mattress, and the bloke who was on before us was reading Winnie the Pooh. And so that was the sort of thing that, you know, it was not professional in the way that it is now. So you just had to try and do as many as you could. And then, of course, eventually we heard about Edinburgh. And, I took a show up to Edinburgh. I was in those days, you used to do, two people would do a show, so you do half an hour each. So Steve's first show up there was with another impressionist called Mike Ailey. And then the next year he went up with Frank Skinner. My first show was with Atty Eyridge from Red Dwarf, you'll probably remember. We did a great show at the Assembly Rooms. And I got spotted. I actually won, don't tell many people this, I actually won the Daily Mail Young Comic. I have never told Steve that information. We may rescind our relationship if I tell him that information. I think they only had it one year. I think after that, you know, the Perrier decided to have a Young Comic Award, and then it was never. So I'm probably the only older of that award. Anyway,
you're still the Daily Mail Young Comic.
Undefeated. I was spotted by. Jo Sargent from the John Blair Film Company, and she came to me and she said, we offered a television series to John Egley, and he don't want it. I love John to bits, but he sometimes, you know, he has his own way of doing things. And I said, well, I'll do it. Yeah, it's great. Sounds good. What is it? And she said, we don't know, what do you want to do? So I said, well, let's do the Muppets, and I'll be Kermit. And she said, who else do you want? And I said, well, Frank Skinner, because I tried to get all the Northern acts on, and they were all my mates. So I said, Frank Skinner could be like a Gonzo sort of character. And then I wanted Linda Smith to play the Miss Piggy. Sort of role, and they said that she wasn't animated enough, and they got Jenny Clear in, and Jenny Clear was brilliant. I didn't know her, but she obviously, once I got to know her, she was absolutely brilliant. And it was quite a cartoony sort of show. But what I did was I got all my mates on. So if you have a look at that show, there's Dave Gorman's on there. Steve did his first ever national character. He played my brother, who actually turned out to be Frank's brother, conning me. It was a great film. I think it was 8:45 minutes, which throwing in the deep end was quite a big thing.
And that was packet three, right?
Packet three. Yeah. So you wore the pink jacket on that, didn't you?
To my regret, yeah. I was quite cool before I went to that. I got long spiky hair, you know, sort of with shaved at the side black. And they sort of said, well, can you cut your hair? And I didn't know any better at the time. And I cut my hair, and they put me this pink jacket. They put me the pink jacket because it was red drapes, and they thought it'd look good. But I looked nothing like who I was. And I felt. And the thing about that was, as well, was they wanted the short, funny bits. And if ever you see me live, you'll notice I do some short, funny bits. I do some long, funny bits. I do some serious bits, and then mix it all up. But I could only do a little bit. So I made a vow after that, whenever I work with people, and I'm sure Nick will bear me out on this, that I wanted to make people express themselves rather than the production trap them into something, because I learned that lesson, and yeah. For me, I felt that was the end of my career, because that wasn't my personality that was up there. It was a little bit of my personality.
That was one of the first bits of advice you gave me. I went into your office and you said, never let anyone dress you in a way that you don't feel comfortable. Yeah. And then you told me about the pink jacket, and I was like, All right, Henry, I'll never let anyone dress me in a pink jacket. That's fine.
And you dress yourself in a way that's uncomfortable.
I undress myself. Yeah.
It is all about expression, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
So essentially, you want to express. So what I did after that show was I got a lot of money from it, as you do from television. So I started the Manchester Poetry Festival. Basically, the money I got, I spent it on the Poetry Festival, and I put all my favourite people, all poets, on that, and it's still going now. So that was 25 years ago, and it's now an international literature festival. So I always think something good came out of that series because it launched a few people, you know, we got a Poetry Festival out of it.
Yeah. You didn't do the follow-up series, did you?
No, I got sacked from it, which was strange because it was actually called Normal Services originally. But I learned a lesson there. Always, when you make the format, always make sure you've got some signature on that because I hadn't. So they could do it without me. But do you know what? I'm glad it launched a lot of people. I'm still friends with lots of people that I worked with back then. That's the great thing about this business. You see people before they're famous, and then when they're famous, they're just the same people, but, you know, with a few more bob, aren't they, really?
Mm. So what was it like touring with Pulp then?
Touring Pulp, it was... not the glamour you'd think it was. Not many people used to turn up. This was before they got famous. So they made about 10 albums before they got famous. And so they were out of Sheffield. And I was living in Chesterfield. And I had a record shop in Chesterfield called Planet X Records. And I basically cashed in my pension from the insurance brokers. I started up this record shop. And so I'd tour with all the bands. And what they'd do is they'd tour like three bands together. And it was called Outrage Entertainment. And the chap who ran Digby's Drill, Oggy, was sort of the main organiser. I don't know if you've ever seen Digby's Drill. I wish they'd have made it big. They were absolutely brilliant ahead of the time. But so what we'd do, we'd turn up to a gig. And I always remember probably the worst one we went to was the... Lucifer's, it was called. That was a name to remember. It was the Morecambe Beer Keller. Right. So the first band to play was Midnight Choir, which was a goth band. They got through one song and the man came and told us to pack up. So we got back in the van and we drove back from Morecambe to Sheffield. He gave us the money. And I always remember going back thinking, we call you an Outrage Entertainment. but even when Paul was on the bill, we'd play places and nobody would turn up. Probably my best gig with them was the Marquee Club in London. Jarvis had fell out of his window, fell out of Russell's window, Russell the violinist, and he broke his legs. And so I had to wheel him on in a wheelchair. You probably remember at the time, I'm going back to the 80s, that Morrissey used to have that false earpiece and he had them glasses where there were no actual lens in them. So it was a bit like, you know, it looked like that Jarvis was doing a sort of up in the game. But he won't, he did genuinely broke his legs. Still danced in his chair though.
He could have stuck with it.
But I used to do the bits between bands. So while the bands were sort of changing over, I'd do, sort of 10 minutes.
Were they kind of hairy gigs at all? Because I guess people aren't there to see poetry, are they?
Well, they're not. But there was a culture of poets doing it at the time. If you think of my favourite was Seething Wells. So Seething Wells, Attila the Stockbroker, Little Brother, all these sort of people were doing stuff at the time. And I call myself Henry Normal because to start off with, I'd still got my suit on from being an insurance broker. So I thought if I get up in front of these punk audiences, I've done the joke before they have. I generally went down well. I got a few good reviews in NME and Sounds, and you know, that was quite nice.
I listened to one of your poems, Love at First Sight, today, and that at the end of it had me crying. I thought that's a beautiful poem. That's from an early radio show that you did, right?
I wrote a lot of love poems in my youth. I mean, obviously, I'm going on a bit now, so you don't think of love in those sort of terms as much. But that love at first sight was a genuine sort of reaction to being in love with a very beautiful woman. I moved to Manchester from Sheffield because somebody I was in love with moved to Manchester, and that was the only reason I went to Manchester and met people. She then moved to London, and I realised I didn't love her that much. When I saw it with Pulp, I actually had an album out. I don't know whether you've ever seen this, Nick, but I had an album called Ostrich Man.
I've not seen it.
I'll send you a copy.
Yes, please.
Yeah, for your collection. But I was a little bit more, because I was younger then, I was a little bit more, I won't say aggressive, but upbeat, shall we say, and a little bit more faster. And, I used to do a lot of things about youth culture. So I do stuff about goths and, and sort of Grebos and things like that. Whereas now you tend to reflect the lifestyle that you're in.
We haven't really scratched the surface on, and we've got like hard rain. We're running out of time.
Okay.
You went from one of my favourite things when I was growing up was the Paul and Pauline Carr video diaries.
Oh yeah.
And Coogan's Run.
Yeah.
So I love those, but probably my all-time favourite bit of TV, and I stand by this, and I bring it up every so often, is the Tony Farino phenomenon.
Yes, yeah. I watched it the other day after watching you. I thought I'll re-watch it, see how it stands up. I was reminded that you love those really bad rhymes. Things don't quite rhyme, and there's some great bad rhymes in Tony Farina phenomenon. I'll tell you a little bit of background to Tony. So Steve thought up the idea of Tony Farina when we were on tour, because I toured with him for the first tour, Live and Lewd, and when we were in the van, we'd just think up song titles. So all we had to start off with. Now, he didn't have, the only name he had to start off with was Tony, which was sort of, if you think about it, sort of like a Frank Sinatra sort of
name. Tony Bennett.
So Tony. And I come up with the name Farino, which was based on Lou Farino, the Incredible Hulk. I just thought it sounded Portuguese. So the very first things that we wrote were basically song titles like You're My Children's Au Pair was one of the first ones we thought. So we were just thinking of, Bigamy at Christmas. We're just thinking of, so first off, we had the idea that he was a Lothario. And then we started talking about things like his dad had been a fascist. And then we started talking about the dodgy sort of, he was involved in murders and basically killing his wives. And it just grew and became a character. And then, he managed to do... It was a very fast turnaround, that show, actually. We wrote it and Steve filmed the entire thing in one night.
Wow. So when I watch it back, right, there seems to be sections that are filmed without an audience and sections
They were filmed during the day, yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay, so the links were filmed separately and then he came out and he did all the songs in one night.
Yeah, all the songs and some of the links. But the things like Papa Bendy, we filmed during the day and they were cutaways which we played to the audience.
That's incredible. I mean, so there's so many songs and they're all almost different genres.
Yeah.
And they're funny in different ways. But also, one of the best titles was a song called Valley of Our Souls.
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah.
And that's so, and it takes ages for the penny to drop on the audience before they get it. And then, like, a couple of years ago, Robert Redford and Jane Fonda made a film called Our Souls at Night.
Oh, yeah.
it was just like it was just absolutely incredible to think that basically Jane Fonda and Robert Redford have made a Tony Farino movie.
One of my best bits of Tony Farino was I don't know whether you've seen this, the interview he had on Clive Anderson.
Yes, that was incredible. Because he did Partridge on Clive Anderson as well, didn't he?
Yeah, well, on the Tony Farino, he was filming a film during the day. So I had to go to his Winnebago. And basically, he was crawling across a floor and he got knee pads on. And he had to keep crawling across the floor and they'd do a take and then he'd come back. And we wrote it in about 2 days, that thing. And I was writing it with him still, because he likes to rewrite throughout the day. And then I went to the show with him and we were rehearsing it all the way through to the show. And the great thing was, when he went on, he forgot some of the lines. But what Clive Anderson did was, he had another guest on and then he had Steve back on as Tony Farino and did all the other lines and then just cut it together. So when you see it, it looks beautiful. And I always respected Clive Anderson for helping him do that. But the most memorable part of the night was the guest that was on before Steve was Gorbachev. And when he came off, he stood next to me. So I was stood with Gorbachev, there's a couple of Evies next to her, watching Steve do Tony Farino, and Gorbachev was laughing.
That's incredible.
I think it's like what you were saying before about TV and collaboration, though. That if you're Clive Anderson, what you want to have at the end of it is the best show.
Yes.
So it makes total sense to bring people back and have another chance to do it.
But when you watch the show and see what an odd time Steve gives Clive Anderson on the show, just realise that Clive Anderson's such a generous man that he helped him, you know, dish out some more insults.
I think that's right, what you're saying about being a producer as well before, because I often think that about, you often see like comics in Edinburgh or comics you know, and I think so often when they get to do TV, they end up doing something which is nothing like their live act. And it seems to remove everything that was sort of special about it in the first place.
Yeah. Nick will tell you, whenever I get people in to Baby Cow when I was working, I did 17 and a half years of Baby Cow. I'd say to them, is this what you want to do? Because if you want to do something else, let's do the something else. You've got to want to do it. And I know, and I'm going to ask you this on camera, Nick, because I know for comic effect, you give a downer on Uncle on stage, and I can understand that. But I love you in Uncle. I absolutely love. I think you added so much to that. That show wouldn't have been that show without you.
Well, I love Uncle, and I love the kid, and I'm still in contact with Ollie and Lila. But the thing is, people just automatically assume that I write Uncle. So it's sort of like this constant frustration where you go, you know, you're in a meeting and people go, wow, yeah, the scripts are amazing. You did great. And you're just like going, oh, you want to talk to the writers. You don't want to talk to me.
But do you know what? As a man who's written for some great actors, right? Some of the jokes I've written over the years wouldn't have been half as funny if I had written for shit actors, right? There's a way people put things over. And also, there's bits in Uncle that are nothing to do with the jokes, that are to do with reactions. So one of the things I used to do in the edit, and I always used to invite you into the edit, if you remember, was I'd look for the reactions that weren't the joke, that were the reactions to the joke, and I could always look to you to get a reaction. And there were episodes where you may not have said as much as you'd like, but we always got the reaction, and very often the reaction would get the laugh. Now, you can't write a reaction.
I did an untelevised pilot once, and the producer on that said, it's amazing. you're acting even when you're not talking. And I was like, yeah, I know, that's the job, right?
Yeah, you see, that comes naturally to you. Now, I remember we had, I wrote a thing with Caroline and Craig called Mrs. Merton and Malcolm, and we had a child actor on it. You won't see this because we cut it out in the edit, but every time he finished speaking, his eyes would go. So as soon as he finished speaking, we'd have to cut to Craig.
I think you're right though, Henry, because I think, like, I remember like seeing Uncle when it started, and it felt like a sort of just such a perfect vehicle for Nick in that way that it felt like, oh, it's like he sort of made it himself. It felt
It was originally cool because we'd done the Blaps together, and I'd had like a meeting. The script came along, and I don't know how long the script had been about. But it was about an out-of-work actor, and I went in for a meeting. I'd read the script, and I went in for a meeting, and I met Ollie, and Henry was there. And Henry was basically like, do you like the script? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, do you like Nick? And Ollie was like, yeah. And then he goes, okay, fine, do you want to work together? And it was like, yeah. And then he goes, brilliant. And you didn't make me audition. Because I still swear that if I'd have had to audition for Uncle, I wouldn't have got it. Yeah, so yeah. I'm really grateful that you did that.
We changed it to a musician as well. That was the great thing.
In that meeting, he said, well, Nick can write songs. So if you make it into a musician, then Nick can do a song in the episodes. And I think me and Ollie went outside and had a little chat about what the tone would be. And then we just did it. I think it was really quick. We did the pilot, and then the pilot came out. And then, yeah, anyway, Shane moved over to BBC Three, and you had connections with BBC Three. And then we went over there because, we were so really quickly running out of time. But, I mean, you're responsible for Marion and Jeff, Nighty Night, Mighty Boosh, Gavin and Stacey, Camping, Hunderby, lots of the Alan Partridge Project. I mean,
Let me put you right on this. I'm not responsible for all those. What I am is part of the team, and I love being part of the team. Now, somebody's got to be the boss, right? But he's still part of the team. So the fact that I ran Baby Cow is just that I fell into that position, that I was able to do that. And being put in that position, I thought, just like when I was on Package of Three, let's get me mates on. So basically, you'll see that on all our shows, people who are in the first things, like Julia Davis, made lots of things with us. People that were on Julia Davis' show, like, Rob came from Julia, made lots of things with us. On the very first show, we had Ruth Jones. She made stuff with us. So it was all about making friends and then having little adventures with our friends. And do you know what? They paid me. Fantastic.
It is. I think it is the way to do it. It's a sort of, I just think there is an element of those people know what they're doing, or they certainly have an idea. And if they come in saying, I want to do this, then surely it's the best way to say, yeah, go off and do that.
That's not how it worked. Because when I did my Blaps with you, I came in, because you're being modest, because when I did my Blaps with you, I came in and I said, well, I'd like to do that. And weirdly, one of the ideas for my Blaps was to do a thing where I was giving bad advice to a kid on a park bench.
Yeah.
So when Uncle came along, it was just like, oh, I was, sure, I don't have to write it. Someone else has written it. So you said, well, look, you've got all these songs, Nick, and you've got like these poems. You should just do, I'd spent like a week trying to write something new. And you said you should just get paid finally for the stuff that you've already written.
Yeah.
And then you came in and you guided me like that. Are those music videos I made with you, they still stand up today. Yeah. They're still Spotify.
We went extra on that No Survivors, and we made a video of it. And even my own PA was your I love that. I love that it made no money whatsoever. It wasn't supposed to make any. It was just a fun thing to do, and that'll last forever.
Amazing video. Yeah,
which is great.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. So thank you for coming. We've got time for a game.
A game.
Going to play a game with you, and then we've got to wrap up. But we've we haven't even scratched the surface. But
can have me back in like a year's time or something.
Absolutely.
But I'm just incredibly grateful for everything you've given me, Henry. So thank you for coming on the show. Nathaniel!
This is the game, Henry. It's called Better or Worse. And you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the previous person based entirely on my own opinion. So you score points.
On your opinion or mine?
On my opinion.
Right, okay.
Beginning with Daniel Day-Lewis. But is Doris Day better or worse than Daniel Day-Lewis? Based on my opinion.
Better.
Worse. Is Darren Day better or worse than Doris Day?
Worse.
Is Tilda Swinton better or worse than Darren Day?
Better.
Is Christian Bale better or worse than Tilda Swinton?
Worse.
You're going worse, are you? I'll go worse.
Worse, he is worse. Is Oliver Reed better or worse than Christian Bale?
Well, he's dead.
He is dead.
probably better.
He is better. Is Jane Fonda better or worse than Oliver Reed?
Oh, no, worse.
Worse. Is Bridget Fonda better or worse than Jane Fonda?
No idea. I'll go worse.
I'm going to say better.
Oh, yeah.
What? She's an
Oliver. Is Henry Fonda better or worse than Bridget Fonda?
Oh, better. Henry Fonda's one of the greats.
Is Peter Fonda better or worse than Henry Fonda?
Worse.
Is Peter Capaldi better or worse than Peter Fonda?
I love the juxtaposition of these things. Worse, I'd say.
I think he's better.
Is he?
Give him a great deal.
They're high cards.
They're all high cards, or some of them are.
Henry scored seven. You scored seven, Henry.
I enjoyed that. If you remember the beginning of Tony Farino, we have a little line which says, and here's the two Bruces, Forsyth and Willis.
Yeah. you are the second person to play the game this season. And you scored one less than Susie Dent last week, so I'm afraid you're currently at the bottom of the league. But there's only two people so far. Have you got anything on the radio to plug?
On the radio, and every about 6 months I do a Radio 4 show, but one's recently gone out, so I think the next one's about communication. So I spend 6 months. This is good for communication, isn't it? Can't even say. researching things, and then I do a show about them. So I'm researching communication at the moment.
Yeah, I say that as well. I spend 6 months doing research, and then I'll do something.
And I'll do some knob gags.
All right, then. So thank you, Henry, for coming on the show. I'll see you all next week on another fun-packed edition of Fan Club, five-star family, fun-size fan club. I've been Nick Helm, this is Nathaniel Metcalf, Henry Normal, welcome to the club!